Making Media tells the story of our media business, Colossus. If you aren't familiar with our platform, make sure to check out joincolossus.com. There you'll find our latest episodes across each of our shows, the transcripts, supporting third-party materials, and even some written content as well. So whether you're an investor or an operator, we're out to create the content that we wish we had when we were in those exact roles. Invest Like the Best, Business Breakdowns, Web3 Breakdowns, and Founders each cover different angles of the ecosystem. And our special series like 50X and Return on India are targeting niche topics. Again, make sure to check out joincolossus.com for more on the platform.
Let's do this.
Welcome to Making Media.
Humans are in an eternal quest for convenience. Save me time, make my life easier.
Gosh, that was such a good start to an interview.
Welcome back to Making Media. Our guest today is Emily Sundberg. Like many of our most creative guests, Emily has a wide-ranging background. For her day job, she writes her newsletter, Feed Me, which I'd categorize as tracking valuable early trends in the consumer and brand space. If you want to know what's going to happen 6 months from now, read Emily's newsletter tomorrow. But she also writes for New York Magazine. She also writes for GQ. She's been featured in the New York Times. And she's published a documentary. So we get into all of that during our conversation. Talk about how she's built up this incredibly valuable, long, wide-ranging list of sources while not being a traditional journalist. And we hit on what's happening in culture and documentaries too. So please enjoy this conversation with Emily. All right, Emily, excited to finally get you on Making Media. This is, as we were saying before we hit record, going to be a wide-ranging conversation. You do many things. You've written for many publications. You write your own newsletter. You film documentaries. But I wonder, if you're at a group dinner and introducing yourself, how do you describe what you actually do?
The past few months, I've settled on I write a daily business newsletter. If you asked me 6 months ago, it probably would have been a little bit more all over the place. It would have been like, I'm a consultant and I write and I just made a movie, but I feel pretty comfortable with the newsletter as a day job now, which is a privilege that it's gotten to that point, that I can confidently say that.
It is a worthy privilege though. As a reader, I will say that. It is interesting to hear you describe it as business. I think it is 100% business. It is very cultural driven. I think many of the business people that Dom and I operate with like to think that they can spot trends early or have a sense of what's actually going on in culture. But I will often find that it's maybe disconnected, maybe 6 months late. You seem to have a knack for doing that. How do you stay in the flow of that information? How have you positioned yourself to just be very much in tune with what's going on and what's emerging as a new trend?
I have a very wide network. So my phone is constantly a source. Different group texts are constantly a source of information for the letter. I have friends who are 18. I have groups chats of college kids that I've become friends with. And then I have guys who are 60 who are telling me what's going on Wall Street. So I owe a lot of the success of the business to the relationships that I've made along the way. And that's kind of how the letter started. I realized that friends who were, you know, working on social media teams at magazines were just as interested in gossip and business news as my friends who are running their family funds. And I started to realize that, I guess, in the wake of COVID, like workplace drama news was something that was coming up a lot. But also, founders started to become personalities and celebrities started to become founders. And there was just this melting of pop culture and business reporting where there was an appetite for something that didn't exactly sound like the Wall Street Journal, but also that wasn't like as watered down as The Skim. I respect The Skim as a business, but I wanted to do something a little bit different. And then that's sort of how the idea of the letter came together. And from day one, I knew I wanted it to be daily because that's the speed at which I consume content. And it works really well. I think now it's sort of become this tool for people every day. And like you said, you're right, like it's culture through the lens of business, but sometimes culture sort of loses its meaning, right? Like any person on my block could technically say that they work in culture. And it's been a blast. It's super fun.
To ask a very naive question, how do you foster that kind of network? When you say it like that, it sounds very straightforward, but very few people have the breadth of the network that you've got and the ability to be able to ask and build these relationships where you actually get meaningful information from them on a daily basis.
I've had a lot of jobs. So that's the first one. After I graduated school, well, I interned a lot in school. I took a lot of classes at night so I could intern during the day. I went to school at FIT in the city. So my work network started at a pretty young age. Before I could drink, I was going to like Yahoo happy hours.
Imagine they have some tales to tell.
And then my first job after school was at New York Magazine. And it was in 2016. So I started working at The Cut, which is the women and culture section of New York Magazine. So you got to think 2016, it's we're breaking Weinstein stories, we're breaking Trump stories. Like it's a very exciting year to be in a newsroom. And my relationships at that magazine, because I was working on a social team, I worked with everyone. All the journalists wanted to have relationships with the people who were running social because they wanted their stories to be prioritized. So that was the first way that I got like a really big network, specifically in the news world very quickly. Because social for brands was still sort of in its early days, I made a lot of relationships at Apple and Meta and Twitter because they wanted publishers to be using their products the right way. And then after I worked at New York Magazine, I worked at a startup, a cookware startup called Great Jones. And I was the first hire there. So I had a lot of exposure to the world of fundraising and board members and marketing a D2C brand. And it was a really nice time to be a D2C brand that advertised on Facebook. And I was very curious about that whole world of venture. And I kind of just listened and I put a pin in it. And I thought, like, I want to revisit this. And then I worked at Meta. And once I started going into the office at Meta, and I guess people started finding out that I worked there, I spent a lot of time online. So I made a lot of relationships with people that I met online and people who worked at Meta. And I found that saying I worked there was like a nice flex to meet different kinds of people. And maybe the way that saying I worked at a cookware startup wasn't. People really want to be friends with you when you work at Meta. Like, help me get a blue check, whatever. And it's like, I can't do that, but I can talk to you about whatever else you're building. And then I started the newsletter, and everybody wants to be your friend when you're writing a newsletter that a lot of people are reading. I form relationships through all those jobs, and I'm able to write about business news and workplace news and different industry news because I've worked at all those places. I'm not just stepping out of Syracuse journalism school and looking down at these companies and writing about them. I've worked in them. Like, they've all paid
shots
me.
Fired at Syracuse. Man.
I mean, that's great. It's just a different kind of business reporting when you can text somebody who's still there and they'll tell you what's happening. Or you can say, I saw how this happened because I was in the room.
With the newsletter, you kind of just mentioned I just started this. There are a lot of people that start newsletters, Substacks, everything that don't get off the ground. So when you were doing that, was that coming from just your internal desire to do it? Were people asking you? Were you sending emails? Like, the success of the newsletter is something I am very curious about, because as I started to read it, I saw what was there, but there are so many out there. So what was the driver, and then how long did it take for it to get humming?
So I started my Substack officially over maybe 2020 during COVID, and I was writing short fiction on it. And one day I got a huge spike in followers because Matt Levine included one of my stories in his newsletter.
Love Matt.
Which was weird because my friends were texting me like, you're... fiction story about like a fucked up girl boss is on my Bloomberg right now.
Can we just get some more context around this specific moment? Yeah. Because I think it's important for me and our audience. Like, what was in the story? How did it even get across his desk?
It was a dystopian story about a girl boss who was running a hot company that was unnamed, but in the beach, and she was giving an apartment tour, like a very Architectural Digest type apartment tour. And then the video crew goes into her basement and she's basically running a sweatshop of women who are losing their minds, and they're keeping her sparkly life alive.
He like referenced it or bring it up. Was it something, a nameless person?
I have to find it. It was like, this is a crazy story about a girl boss. And it was at the bottom part where he just like lists a bunch of links. But enough people clicked it that I gained maybe 1,000 readers on this platform that was still getting started. And then I went dark and I didn't publish anything on it for 2 years until I decided to come back at the end of 2022. When I first started it, I was just kind of promoting it on my Instagram. So saying to the world, it's like this embarrassing thing of when anybody becomes a creator, like you're writing to nobody, you're performing for nobody. But 4 or 5 weeks after I started doing the daily newsletter, I wrote a story for New York Magazine about the idea of Shopee Shops, which is, it ended up being a story about Faire, the tech company that's sort of a wholesale marketplace, but also just the homogenous state of retail, where when you walk into a hotel lobby store in Austin or a wine store in Portland, Maine, or a bookstore in Manhattan, you're seeing Graza olive oil and the same vinegar brands and Fishwife. And it was about why suddenly everywhere is selling the same exact Instagram CPG brands. And it all led back to that company Faire. So that story went to number one on New York Magazine for a few days. I think people were looking up who I was and they were getting led to my newsletter. So people from the tech world were reading it. People from the CPG world were reading it. And then people who have just been shopping and witnessing this for the past few months started reading it. So whenever I write something for another publication, people organically find it. And then occasionally I'll see spikes in readers from Forerunner or from different funds, and then their portfolio companies start subscribing. So I know that there's something that probably happened in like an internal communication. And then since then, the letter's been mentioned in the Times and in the Wall Street Journal and in the Washington Post. So I'll always get a new kind of reader from there that wouldn't have discovered me otherwise. And then Substack has their own algorithm. So people discover me the same way that they would find people on an explore page on Instagram. So that's kind of it. I mean, I don't really post on Instagram that often or my Twitter about the letter, but it's a few different ways that it's grown.
The story on Faire actually solved one of the mysteries that I had in my life, which was how the Saratoga water bottles basically overtook every office space, the blue water bottles. And it was mm-hmm. like, what happened to San Pellegrino and Perrier and all the other water brands? And that was the answer. So it was a particularly timely and interesting insight. I am curious about the article that you wrote. How did that come to be? Did they seek you out? Did you reach out to them to do something? What made that come to life?
The story came out in January of 2023. What really switched something for me was Black Friday of 2022. I opened my phone on Black Friday and I saw a lot of businesses saying like, please support us on Black Friday, like doing this emotional plea with their customers saying like, we are this women-run business, or like, we are this whatever, we're just a small team of people. And in my head, I was like, I know who invested in you. You're not just this small mom and pop. I don't know why you're speaking to me like this. And at the same time, I know plenty of people who would pick up a venture-backed product, and because of the packaging or where it was placed at the small town coffee shop, they assumed that it was this tiny little twee thing that only they knew about. And I sort of wanted to strip that back, be like, you're not the only person who discovered this small product. It's actually in every small town and small store in America. How did it get there? It's not good or bad. It ended up being sort of a ink blot test for people, because some people read it and they thought like, wow, Emily is supporting these tiny Shopee shops. And then some people read it and they were like, you're slamming businesses just for existing. And that's my favorite kind of story to write, where I don't say something is good or bad and people can take away from it what they want. So it started with that, and then it slowly turned into a story about FAIR as I started digging into it and finding out more about how these products were ending up everywhere.
Did you reach out to New York Magazine to do that story, or did they?
I pitched it to my editor.
Yeah.
It wasn't about FAIR originally. It was about why the same products are showing up everywhere and what does it mean to communicate with your brand. It was initially about the idea of small washing. So like washing your brand to make it seem like a small business when you've really raised a ton of money. And then it turned into a story about Shopee shops. And if you read the story, it mentioned small washing maybe once or twice, but it was really more about this Decacorn tech company. But it started as a pitch, I think, in my pitch subject line to Alan, my editor, who's incredible, and he's edited a few of my stories there. It was about small washing.
How do you think about where to write pieces like that? You have your own platform now where you could write that, or you could put it in a magazine like this piece. What's the thought process behind that?
Well, I didn't have my letter then. And if I did, I probably would have just written it for my letter. And the reason I write for New York Magazine is because I used to work there and I have relationships there. And they sort of know my beat, which is for them, it's like food and culture. I wrote another story that really blew up about how everyone's drinking whole milk again. And then the subject line ended up being like, hot girls are drinking whole milk. And then that blew up and was a number one story. I wrote another story last year about an influencer, which exploded in some crazy ways. But that's why I pitched New York Magazine. But since I've started this letter, I don't write for magazines as much, because if I have an idea, I turn it around within a day or two. And I miss having an editor. I'm actually working on a story right now for GQ that originated because my editor there saw something I wrote for the letter. So there's like a flywheel. And I was talking to somebody this morning about how when you're writing a newsletter, you're also running your own business. So if you want to have an editor, you have to hire someone or like annoy your friends and have them read it. I actually just hired an intern. This is his second day. And it's added like another hour to my day, which is super valuable.
Just out of curiosity, both these pieces you mentioned, the headline has been important, Shopee Shop or the Hot Girls piece. On a very broad sense, how much do you think the headline makes the piece and the other way around?
A lot. Shopee Shop, I hear it all the time now. And I didn't come up with that term. I actually interviewed somebody on TikTok who came up with that term. His name's Neil, and he's wonderful. But it was just so perfect because it captures the story so well. And the hot girls drinking whole milk is the same thing. And I think New York Magazine is known for that and has always been excellent with that sort of coining terms, whether it was GorpCore, Anna Delvey being the scammer. Like, they're really good at, and I think that their digital product has done that incredibly, but they're really good at knowing what terms can sort of vibrate through the culture.
Are there generalizable lessons about like how, is there something like if you think of a title and it's still with you like 3 hours later before you've published, that's probably a good one, versus if you think about one, you're like, oh, I just don't know. Are there kind of like things that you see as markers for what is great and how you could make a title from good to great?
It's more of like a gut thing. And I try not to be annoying with it. I kind of realized this week, I started writing about the idea of corporate fetish, how so many fashion ad campaigns take place in an office right now. The past, I would say, 3 or 4 weeks, there's been over 20 fashion campaigns that launched, and it's the idealized American psycho version of an office of beautiful women in suits working at these old computers. And I started writing about it and I was like, oh, am I just replicating the mob wife trend that happened a few weeks ago? Am I just making up these things? Like, can terms be respected anymore? Or is it like annoying TikTok noise? For those two stories, I think it worked well because they originated from a magazine and not just girls on TikTok who have 20 followers making up something. I think the medium matters, but I try not to be annoying with them. I'm sure people are going to get annoyed anyway.
It is interesting to see what sticks too when you try to coin things. I always think of Mean Girls making fetch happen.
Yeah.
What can actually stick.
Yeah.
And catch a storm. And a lot of people try it and they just don't stick. And then it's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. You mentioned something before about social media. You were very much involved in social media early in your career. Now you don't use it that much to promote the newsletter necessarily. Is that taking a view on where social media is and how it should be used?
No, my Instagram feed only has 2 posts right now. 2 weeks ago, it didn't have any posts. And I think I just felt like I was giving so much of myself to my newsletter that I wanted to pull back where I could other places and wait to turn on those levers until I needed to. And I'm probably getting close to a point where I need to if I want to expand my audience and market this thing in a specific way. And I do post on Instagram stories. I like to repost when people post screenshots of my letter. On Twitter, I just mess around. Like if you look through my Twitter, there's no strategy there. I think I feel really lucky that there are people who opt into my newsletter each day, whether they're paying or not. They're choosing to be there every day. And there was something kind of weird for me last year that people were happening on my coming to my Instagram page without choosing to be there. And I wanted to just be in front of people who wanted to be in my world for a little bit. I don't use TikTok. But I know that to like grow my business, I'm going to have to start moving over to some other mediums. Maybe I'll play with Discord or something.
Let us know how it goes.
When you think about your audience, does it roughly fit kind of 50% culture? Not that that's necessarily a word for an audience, and then 50% business. Is it a kind of split between, I guess, consumers and business people or investors? Or how do you think about it? Or maybe the answer is, I don't think about it. I think about what interests me. And like as a proxy, that will do pretty well.
I would love to know more about the demographics or at least be able to segment my audience a bit more. Substack doesn't have that many segmentation abilities. So every time I've had to learn about my audience, I've had to make my own surveys. I sent one out on January 1st to get a better idea of who my readers are, where they live, how old they are. I need to do another one to find out what industries they work in because right now I only know based on that maybe the 100, 150 that email me regularly. And that's the most community I sort of have right now. Again, I could probably be using more chat features on Substack, but I do want to make sure that I'm not relying completely on Substack for the future of whatever I'm building. But I would love to know more about what they do. Based on the emails I get, it's a lot of people who are business owners, whether they're like traditional founders or just run other kinds of business. A lot of people work in finance and consulting, a lot of students, and then I think people just generally interested in this kind of news. So I guess it's split. I don't know. I mean, if you guys have suggestions on how to get a better idea of that, I'll take them.
Very platform dependent, and many are increasingly opaque in terms of the data they give you, but surveys help for sure. I am curious about how you decide on what to write. Like you wrote about the Bigelow Pharmacy, which I lived around the corner from that for a long time. So it was very interesting to hear inside.
You want to know how that one came about?
I'd be really curious. Yeah.
Okay. My dad was Alex's teacher. My dad works at a high school on Long Island. And one day Alec emailed me and said, is your dad Dr. Sundberg? I was like, yeah, he is. And then I called my dad. My dad was like, he was a great student. I got him into a high school class and he was in middle school, all this stuff, blah, 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 blah. So finally I was like, Alec, let's meet. Because whenever I'd write about beauty or wellness, he would have these great background stories about how deals were put together, stuff that he's seen. He knows so much. The way that he analyzes different trends is so different than me. I get self-conscious about my reactive nature or hot takes. I can tell he like really thinks before he responds to my newsletters. And I just thought, you know, this guy's smart. My dad taught him. Like I should meet him. And then, as I said, I went to school in the city and I always knew about C.O. Bigelow, but I didn't know how much history that building had or that business had. And in December, this TikTok was going viral about where Carolyn Bessette Kennedy bought all of her headbands, and it was C.O. Bigelow. And the first thing Alec told me was that TikTok completely changed their inventory order. Like it exploded their business and they were like rethinking their social strategy because of it. And then we just had this amazing conversation. But those are my favorite types of stories. I don't answer PR people. I don't answer people who are like, talk to this founder working on this amazing content management system. They would love to be featured in Feed Me. Like, there's plenty of publications that will do that. I try to look more for people who are doing something in a way that I respect or that I'm curious about or that I don't understand.
It was an awesome story. Yeah. And then the whole thing with the Hamptons Pharmacy too, just added another layer of intrigue to it.
Oh, I'm obsessed with pharmacies now. I mean, the oldest pharmacy on Nantucket just closed. So now I'm like, what's going to happen? Are they going to have to go to shore to like go to CVS? And then there's all these stories about the Hamptons pharmacies, which is another, I mean, I'm obsessed with the subcultures and the businesses in the Hamptons also, because it's such a specific economy and it has a really strong seasonal angle to it. And it's just intriguing. So I write about the Hamptons a lot too.
Yeah. Specific economy is one way to definitely put it. It's large and dense. Yeah. I guess on the idea of content and what to write, like that's a really interesting organic story that just came to be in a really unique way. Do you think about when you set out for what you're going to publish the next day or that morning, trying to hit on certain topics or certain stories? Like, is there anything that actually is driving the content that you are publishing?
It's different every day. Sometimes it's like a hot tip I get from a friend who just saw an investor deck and is like, you should throw this in the letter. And then some days, like I did a big deep dive of Rent the Runway's credit restructuring deal maybe 2 months ago. And that did crazy numbers. Like people were like, this was incredible. I never really cared about this company. I might not care about it tomorrow, but today I care about it. And this was a great breakdown. Or other people were like, I didn't even know what a credit restructuring situation is. And that took me a few hours when I decided to write about it because I needed to call friends to make sure I was correct about everything that I was writing.
That sounds like another Matt Levine special there. If he didn't pick it out, we can send it back to him.
Yeah, I should forward it to him. But it really depends on the day and where I see like the puck moving in terms of what people are excited about. I have this nice feedback loop with my readers now where they'll send me stuff that I might have not seen otherwise, whether it's local news or stuff that they're seeing in their email inboxes or stuff that's happening in their office that I don't know about. So it's really become like this thing that I don't want to use feed. It's in the name of my letter, but like I'm giving to my readers, they're giving to me. It's like this really close, intimate thing. I often describe it as intimate. It feels like that to me. And then in terms of like how I actually put it together every day, I don't really talk about how that happens. I like to have a little bit of mystery around the lab, but I write it every morning. It's not like something I do at night and then ship it at 9 a.m. Most of it happens in real time. I have to go to bed early every day to be up to do it.
Yeah, so the morning of the day. Mm-hmm. It's interesting how you have like managed to foster that close connection with your audience, where a lot of people will say when they're writing, they find that a challenge because you write something, people might read it, they might really enjoy it. Not everyone responds to it. They go about their day. They have that your thoughts kind of rushing around their brain. Whereas something like podcasting, say, you do feel a bit closer to it because you kind of plugged into someone's ears and like it feels like you know the person on the other end, you know what they sound like, etc. It's maybe a little bit more of an intimate medium. So it's cool to hear that you kind of have this ongoing dialogue, I guess, with maybe your diehard fans, if we can call them that.
Yeah. And 75% of the letter is usually under a paywall. So those people get to know me a little bit better and I'll drop in like anecdotes about my life or stuff that I'm doing or places that I'm hanging out. And then people will email me and say like, I was hanging out there too, or like, you should do this, or we live in the same neighborhood, or I saw you yesterday, or they'll stop me on the street. Like there's a photo of myself in every single letter. To start off, they're getting photos of me exhausted in the morning every single day. So there's that facial recognition thing happening. It's a very voicey letter. I wrote something for the Times once and they were like, you can't say I or me. And I was like, I probably can't write this. It's a very voicey letter that reads more like a podcast sometimes. And that was conscious. I think that my value is probably less in deep journalism and more in entertainment. And I'm happy to do that. I'm pretty vigilant about the links that I'm curating and my opinions on them. I don't think maybe two or three times I've written something that I regretted. I feel very good about what I'm putting out. It's not always the common take. I don't have advertisers. I have nobody to make happy besides myself and my readers. And I think that that attitude is also received really well, and it's probably somewhat refreshing.
You mentioned in the longer form pieces that you'd written that you really liked the fact that you didn't have an opinion per se. You just wrote about something that was interesting. You presented the arguments and people can form their own opinion on whatever the piece says. Whereas I think on the shorter form stuff that you do daily, you have more of an opinion and you're willing to say stuff either for or against whatever it is that you're surfacing. How do you think about those two? Is it simply the medium, like one is shorter form, one is longer, and that explains it? Or is there something else at play?
I think when you write for a national magazine, my opinion doesn't hold as much weight. They just want to know the story. They want me to find out what's going on. When I'm in Emily world, the one thing that sets me apart from all the other writers at Substack doing link news, link letters, roundup, whatever, is me. That's what people are paying for. If somebody else was writing it, it wouldn't sound like that. When New York Magazine hires me or another magazine hires me, increasingly it's becoming more about Emily and my point of view. But when I was starting, it was more about the story that I was uncovering. I also think you can do two things at once. I believe that you can be two kinds of writers.
You mentioned the image in each newsletter. Was there an intentional strategy behind that?
Yeah.
In terms of
yeah. I like grew up on the internet. So like I understand the value of having a face to a byline to the account holder. And I like that it fosters that sort of relationship with my readers. I don't know how that will age. I don't think I can do that forever. This thing will probably have to get a little bit more polished up at some point. But right now, it's fun.
I would encourage you to stick with it. The authenticity of it. A lot of people think as they grow, they have to become this. But I think a lot of what makes you successful and other people in a similar boat is because it is you. It's real. It's not about, you know, like presenting something that you think other people should want. It's like, no, this is what I want and what people naturally gravitate to.
And it works. It's working.
I think it's really smart, to be honest. I want to take a quick detour to documentaries and filmmaking. You made one about Gardner's Island, and it's awesome. It's 15 minutes. I want to know the origin story behind that, and then we can kind of bring it back together, talking between writing and making films.
Sometimes I forget I made a movie. As I mentioned, I'm from Long Island. I found out about that island later in life than I probably should have, considering I spent a lot of time in Montauk growing up. And when I found out that that island existed, I was at an ex-boyfriend's yacht club in Amagansett, which is in the Hamptons. And I didn't know what the mass of land was in front of me. And his dad explained what it was to me. And he was saying that there are giant tortoises that lived on the island that don't live anywhere else and all these other animals. And like, that is what hooks me with these things. I'm like, wow, a local Galapagos. Look at this. We broke up. Life went on. I kept thinking about that story. I thought, okay, can I pitch something to New York Magazine or the Times about it? But there was no timely peg to it. I can't just write, this island exists. Then there's one house on it and nobody will talk to me about it. So over COVID, like in 2020, I applied to Adobe for a creative grant and I got, I think, $3,000. And I called my friend and I said, do you guys want to go to the Hamptons for a week? I'll pay for the Airbnb with the $3,000. We'll all get tested for COVID and be in this house. And I want to talk to a few guys out there who work at the historical societies and the museums. And they were like, sure, great. I have a friend group who all went to Kenyon College and they all work in film now. So they had the equipment, which reduced a lot of costs. And they got a free week in the Hamptons to get out of the city during the winter. I got labor. We went out there, we shot a bunch of these men. I researched in a lot of local Long Island history Facebook groups. I would post and say, hey, I'm working on this thing. Does anybody have stories? The amount of stories that came out of there, the amount of rumors, crazy old guys calling me being like, you have to pay me $100,000 and I'll tell you what really happened. Like, amazing, perfect characters. That was what made the story so successful. So we shot out there for a few days, started looking at the footage. I said, you know what? I think that there's something here. I got access to some archival imagery from historical societies and libraries out there. I went out a few more times, kept shooting, kept it super lean. One of my coworkers from Meta helped me edit it. I did all the graphics and I designed the poster. I drew it at home, like scanned it. And then that was it. And then I submitted it to a bunch of festivals and I didn't think anything would happen. And then it got into some great festivals. It got some nice press. I also put a classified ad in the local newspaper in East Hampton and got some, that's how I met one of the people who like connected me to the most resources. I think the whole project is $20,000.
Yeah. I'm not a film connoisseur, but it's either a yes or a no in terms of the quality. And it looks like a very highly produced documentary to me. And it's pretty awesome.
My ex produced it and we broke up before we finished it. That probably affected the quality, but I think all things considered, it turned out pretty well.
Totally. Yeah. Had you gone in with much film experience? And if not, when you came out of it, how would you reflect on that medium now? Like, is it something that you want to do more of? Or is it something that's like, that's a time and a place, I'm good?
I didn't have much film experience, but I know how to use a camera. And I've always known how to like take a nice photo or shoot a nice video on my iPhone. I've had an iPhone since I was in eighth grade. I've always known how to make nice imagery. And I love documentaries as a medium. I grew up watching PBS. I have friends who are documentary filmmakers. I think it's usually like a less sexy, exciting part of Hollywood, but it also leaves more opportunity because it's not like the most exciting, competitive area. What do I think about it now? I would probably try to raise some cash next time because that put me into debt that year a little bit, or like it was hard.
I go out on a limb and say the Adobe grant wasn't very generous.
Yeah, no. I have friends who are all like getting money from Peter Thiel to make their movies. I should have hit him up. So that's something I would do next time. I think I probably wouldn't make a movie with my romantic partner. I don't think I'd work with significant other again. Don't quote me on that. You never know. But I would definitely make a film again. I would definitely make a documentary again. I have lots of ideas. I would probably approach it differently, probably give myself a little bit more time. I also was working at Meta at the time. So this was happening after hours and on weekends. I wasn't able to give it all of my energy. And I think most people who make films are probably like giving themselves way more to the craft. The whole process and even like sitting through these film festivals and seeing other people's work, it was really nice to just get out of my media circle for a little bit and say I did something that with the newsletter, I'm not doing something novel. I go into any restaurant and there are tons of people who do the same thing I do. On Instagram, I'm constantly being tagged in lists of people's favorite newsletters and I know half the people on there because they're my friends and we came up in similar ways. So when I made a movie and it got into festivals, I was like, okay, this is cool. It's like, gives me like a little bit of a different edge. And I can say that I studied something a little bit different. I struggled learning how to edit and submit these things. And it was a good experience to have.
My impression of the documentary world is that it's art and one of the highest forms. But from a monetary standpoint, I'm not sure that it really follows through. Is that a fair takeaway?
Yeah, I think that's fair. The HBO and Netflix sensational documentaries about this cult in Hawaii or like this crazy
true crime
vegan or like this scammer, like those types of stories are selling like crazy. And you could open the New York Times right now and probably find five stories that are being optioned for either docuseries or scripted projects. But none of the stuff I work on is really that category, like that fast of turnaround. And if you're doing something like that, you're probably in bidding wars with like other people trying to make the same thing. Like I can't imagine how many people made scripts about Caroline Calloway or Anna Delvey or whatever Firefest.
Yeah, I mean, there were two that came out right at the same time. So it tells you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I think that's probably where more of the money is. Those viral things that people watch and then 2 years later, they don't remember the name of. My friend Lance Oppenheim is making really awesome documentaries. He made one about the Villages in Florida, that living community, which is incredible. And then he just premiered another one at South by last week about a Renaissance fair in Texas, where people, I think, like actually believe that they're living in a Renaissance
medieval
world.
Times. Yeah.
And then I'm seeing another one of his, I don't know how he does so much. You guys should look him up. He's awesome. I'm seeing another one of his movies tonight at Metrograph in New York, and it's called Sperm World, and it's about sperm donors. His medium is documentaries. People are really excited about his work. He's great.
And I guess is the ticket there that you hope something gets optioned to a Netflix? What would drive you to do, and this is comes across as a very incredible, shallow, business-oriented mind question, but what would drive you to do another one? Is it simply like having something out there, putting something out there that you feel really good about? Is there a business angle to it?
I have ideas all the time. I've taken some really great meetings with people who are like, if you can pull this off, we'll fund it. And some of them are like execs that you'd know the names of. But some of them aren't possible. I made a movie about an island and nobody who is involved with the island today would speak to me. Thank God I had these characters who were able to tell me all of their conflicting stories about the truth. And that was what the movie was. But most of the subjects that I would want to speak to aren't interested or like get really shady. Some of my other story ideas, you know, I say them to people and they're like, that's not landing for me. And that is enough for me to shut it down. And it shouldn't be, because I'm sure plenty of people double down on stuff that other people say no to. But at the end of the day, I would want my next project to be like for the masses. And I would want more people to be excited about it than some of the ones that I've talked about. And then it's like a time thing, time and money thing. Yeah. Would you guys ever make a movie?
I would love to. The thing that you've talked about is the high upfront cost means that there are serious constraints to be able to do it. Like if you go to someone who might fund it and they say it's not landing for me, there's like a short of going to find, you know, another 50 people with money to see like whether it lands with them. It becomes just a bit of a painful process before you've even done anything. But yeah, at some point it'll be awesome.
Yeah. The challenge of getting the people to agree to allow you to make the documentary has always been the thing that I've run into. But yeah, I have a few ideas. Yeah.
I watched some that were made, like some of my favorite ones about like young people or communities or places that were made 20 years ago. You couldn't look up those people on Instagram afterwards. Like they kind of just went on living their lives unless you saw the movie. Where today, even like that sorority movie that came out last year, it wasn't good because why would anyone in a sorority subject themselves to America's criticism if they want to have a job one day? So the subjects that that woman ended up speaking to were like not that great of subjects, and it made the story really weak. And then, yeah, I think it's a lot harder to make movies about people if it's controversial, because people know that like that can just reverberate around the whole internet and then their lives are over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The times have certainly changed in that regard. You don't go back to living the life that you were living before, no matter how big or small it is. Going back to the trend spotting, being kind of in the flow of what's going on in culture, I do think it's actually very relevant for investors. And it's just the type of thing of like, how can you actually take what you see? It's like, okay, martinis and fries, like that being something, it's like, okay, I can't really necessarily make money off of that. But how much engagement do you have with investor types who are interested in trend tracking and then actually put it to use? Do you see that?
I've gotten like advisor for equity deals. I've gotten like some nice, sexy opportunities through the letter where people at either holding companies or PE firms call me and they're like, hey, can we have you on speed dial? We'll give you equity in this thing that we're launching. And I'm happy to do that. Tons of people send me their decks for brands that they're launching. I wrote a lot about fragrance over the past few months. I took a fragrance course last semester, actually, because I saw that this was part of the beauty industry that was exploding. I mean, since I started that class, there have been some major exits for fragrance brands. And I was grateful that I was in that class because I was able to write about it better. And then I sort of became a go-to for a lot of brands who are thinking about launching fragrance businesses this year. I mean, if you guys open Business of Fashion on any given day, you're seeing that news. So plenty of investors or finance or whatever venture people have hit me up asking for my advice or asking if I'd be interested in speaking to their teams. Again, like I've been my letter's been quoted in Wall Street Journal or Washington Post stories. And I think the fact that I have the network that I do and that I live in New York and I spend a lot of time out in the world makes this letter like a great source for those types of people, which is why I see entire teams at some of these funds read the letter every day and forward it around.
No, it makes a lot of sense. I was thinking about it in a less direct way, but it makes way more sense to just do it in a very direct fashion where you're directly involved with the investments or the businesses that they're launching. So yeah, it absolutely does.
That's the less public part of the whole thing. Yeah.
Do you think about that as part of the business model going forward? If you think about what you're doing into the future, obviously you have a successful newsletter that people pay for to read. Is there kind of like a business tier that taps into some of what you've been talking about, or do you see it evolving in a different way?
Yeah, I've thought about the more B2B offerings that I could have, whether that's trend reports on certain topics or doing more events. I'm one person, so all of this gets very overwhelming when I sit down with traditional media guys and they're like, why don't you have these ad sales actions set up? Why aren't you advertising on your letter? Why aren't you showing up to all these things and being on panels? I have an apartment to clean. I have laundry to do. I'm one person. I don't have an editor. And now I have my amazing intern that I met through the letter. Like, so he's going to help me become a billionaire. But yeah, going forward, I do have plans. I want to like formalize some of the other things that I have going on. 6 months ago, I was probably more like, I can consult for your brand. I can spend X hours a day helping your team and like integrating into your team. And I was doing more traditional consulting, but it's really hard to do that when you have another business to run because it does take so much of me and like my personal opinion and editing and answering so many emails and doing like community management that way. Hopefully we're getting to a place where that is more systemized. And if anybody listening to this wants to help me, give me a call.
You'll get a lot of advice. Help is different than advice. We feel your pain sometimes on that stuff. Yeah. Like it's flipping on a switch to do all that other stuff. We'll wind down here. This has been excellent. While we've been talking about culture and trends, we do have to at least introduce one form of opinion or commentary in terms of what you're watching for, whether it's like over the summer, over the next 6 months. What are the most interesting dynamics? If you can point to one or two that you see out there that people should be paying attention to that maybe aren't quite obvious yet or mainstream yet.
I'm very interested how all these newsletters are going to shake out, like people quitting their jobs to start a newsletter. I don't think they realize, or some of them do, but to be so tethered to a platform and do it alone in hopes of making money without like a support team or insurance or all these things, I'm very curious about it. And obviously it's louder to me than people who aren't working in like the general media industry, but I see a lot of people betting everything on Substack. And then from the other side, like you subscribe to 10 newsletters, that's $50 a month. So I think they're going to have to figure out, like Substack as an app is going to have to figure out some sort of bundling strategy because I don't see it as a completely sustainable model the way it's heating up so much right now. I see a lot of people joining that platform in hopes of like making money. So I'm curious about the newsletter industry, keeping my eyes on Puck and, you know, all these New York Magazine newsletters and seeing how brands play around with newsletters. If you asked me a few weeks ago, I probably would have said fragrance, but I'm kind of tired of seeing all the fragrance brands now.
It's funny because I think I have been reading you writing about it, but I actually don't think it's as mainstream as you can imagine. It's an interesting dynamic when you're really in the weeds.
I mean, in the beauty world, it definitely is.
Beauty in general, too. I mean, it's just
unbelievable
what's happened over the past, I would call it, decade.
Yeah.
And I'm a layer removed from it. But one of the things I had in my outline was like, when are male beauty brands going to become a thing? And like, there's obvious reasons why female is different than male, but it's one of the seven deadly sins, vanity, right?
I think you're probably more embedded in beauty than you think you are. If you look at the category of beauty and wellness. That's fitness. That's a lot of products that you're probably buying at the drugstore. That's like basic interactions that you're having with any type of tool or product you're using in your hair, whatever skincare experience you're having. You're probably more embedded in it than you think you are. And I don't think men's makeup is ever going to be a universal thing. The same thing with like anti-aging and ice plunges and saunas, like that's all beauty and wellness to me. It's the same idea at the end of the day, which is like, how do I look better, feel better, live longer? That's like the essence of the beauty industry. And I think eventually keeping my eye on like med spas and aesthetics and all of that, like that category fascinates me too. I mean, look at Ozempic. That I think could technically fall under the category of beauty and wellness. That has changed. Did you guys watch the Oprah special last night?
No.
You guys should watch it.
My favorite interviewer. I will have to watch it.
Yeah. I mean, it was an hour long singing the praises of Ozempic.
Yeah. Interesting.
Living in a different country, the Ozempic thing is just totally fascinating to me because it's very different over here.
You guys just smoke cigarettes. Yeah. And that's
your, we don't even have water bottles. Ozempic. We did get out of the tap.
It's big here.
So yeah, I would say like Substacks, always keeping an eye on that. Beauty and wellness, always keeping an eye on that. Actually, speaking of cigarettes, a lot of people are using Zyn.
Yeah, that's a big one and increasingly mainstream.
Somebody said I should make like fun Zyn cases for my readers.
There you go.
So.
Branded. I like it. I probably did have too small of a idea in my head of what beauty really was when I could expand on it. And when you put it in that perspective in terms of all the other things, including cold plunges and whatnot.
You into cold plunges?
No. I've done one once. Not my thing. Maybe it will be.
No, yeah.
Yeah, it's prefer the warmth, but they seem to work. And even if it's placebo, I respect the placebo effect. It's one of the best things out there. Yeah, very, very interesting. This has been a lot of fun. Just to close it out, we like to always get a sense of what other people are really into in terms of whether it's media networks or businesses or just actually like what they're consuming. What else are you consuming throughout the day? I think you've referenced a few brands, but like, is there anything that you point to that you think is either a business or a person doing a particularly good job that you watch closely and try to either pull away the best ideas, emulate, whatever it might be?
You guys know what I've been listening to a lot? Founders.
Okay. Oh, Senra. Yes.
Yeah. It's great. I've been listening to that a lot and it hypes me up. What else do I really like? I think Lauren Sherman at Puck is awesome. I think the way that she writes about the fashion industry is great.
Those are two good answers. I mean, you got speaking for the team and then Puck and Lauren. Obviously, we think pretty highly of everything that they're doing over there. And it's very interesting to see the success that they've had with a particular model. When you mentioned Substack bundling, I think to myself, well, you could just team up and create an all-star team to found your own Puck. And that's an option as well.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for joining us. It was overdue and sharing the knowledge. Yeah, look forward to continuing reading what you're doing and seeing what you have in store. It sounds like everything's evolving. So excited to see what's next.
Thank you guys for having me. This was so fun.
I think you've got a confession to make. You said you don't do cold plunges.
Mm-mm.
But I have it on good authority from you that you do cold showers. Is that in the same genre?
Oh, I consider that very different.
All right. Do you want to explain that to me?
One involves just turning the knob on a shower to a certain temperature. The other involves having a large piece of equipment that typically takes a lot of time to actually get cold unless you're in a frigid area. And yeah, I just put them in two totally different categories. I also only do cold showers if I'm very hot after a run or I'm outside for a long period of time. So it's actually less habitual and more specifically after certain things. Yeah.
You're specifically just trying to cool down. That doesn't sound like, it's just like you've got a tepid shower, not a cold one by the sounds of it. You're just trying to get that core body temperature down. I thought you were doing them in the mornings. First thing, get up, feel like you've done something difficult, then the rest of the day will fly by like a breeze.
You got the wrong guy.
But I did enjoy you saying that you were one step removed from beauty. That gave me a good chuckle. And then I liked how Emily corrected you on a number of different counts.
Yeah, it was a fair correction. Honestly, I think it's one of those things where there's probably a market. Again, vanity is one of the deadly sins. And usually if you build businesses around those, you can be quite successful. And it just seems so obvious with all of these female brands doing it that there's an opportunity for male brands, but it's probably happening more than I realize. And I'm just not in the know there.
Probably true. I have two funny stories that I feel like I need to get off my chest related to this. The first one is you've done a podcast interview with someone else where you were in the guest seat and you were asked what your skincare routine was. Is that right?
That is correct. Yes. That one caught me off guard.
There was no layup for that question. And out of curiosity, what is your skincare routine?
I just moisturize now, increasingly so. Probably should have moisturized about 10 years ago, but yeah.
You'll get there. I was told the other day that we should moisturize with SPF as well. I don't know if that's,
Yeah, well, if you saw me after recently being in a warm weather climate, you would agree that that is good advice. A lot of very beneficial.
Yeah.
For multiple reasons, yeah.
And the other story is that I was with you once and I was wearing aftershave like a normal human being. And you were like, what is that? We don't do that in this country. Maybe there are cultural differences here as well.
It was potent is what I would say. You know, like some people will put a dab of cologne close to their neck. You have to be very close to the person, practically whispering in their ear. I think that you were about 300 yards down the way around the block when I got this hint of a smell. And I wasn't sure if there was a gas leak or something going on, but it was very apparent once you got closer where it was coming from.
I'll have to tell my wife you referred to her aftershave as a gas leak. Anyway, back on track. I thought that was particularly informative. My reflection on it is that nothing necessarily will blow you over. In like, I mean that in the best compliment to what she's doing, what she's built. Everything is really smart, from adding more personality to her writing, to the way she's leveraging the network she's built over time. In stark contrast, I've worked in other places where I don't speak to the people where I used to work, where they probably would be some benefit to me doing that on a more ongoing basis. Every part of her career so far, she's done very thoughtfully, and everything she said made a ton of sense to me.
We probably could have spent the entire episode on the journalism aspect to it, because she is basically, it's this really interesting feedback loop of she'll put something out there and then oftentimes the next day she'll have a lot of the replies who were from people in the know of whatever situation she was describing. And clearly she's getting information and sources on the ground and these things. So that's something that I could have talked for a while about, because when you're able to communicate with people that are 60 and then people in college, newsflash, like not many people are actually able to balance both of those things and include both of those in their audience. So I think that's like a skill set. And it doesn't feel like she's been deliberate about it. It feels like it's something that comes natural, to your point, when you work at these businesses. Like many people would just accept the job and just kind of go about it, not necessarily form relationships with the people in the different departments, even if you're working with them a lot. So that's a major takeaway for me. And the second one was just on like the optionality that she's created. And I think it really stems from putting opinions out there. So I think we feel this sometimes too, is you can be part of content by just sharing someone else's story, which is great. And I think it's super helpful. It does not get you in the door with a lot of business opportunities the same way that sharing opinions, they need to be good, well-formed opinions. They need to have some type of insight that other people don't have. But that is a major difference just in terms of the media landscape. And as she mentioned, it opens up a lot of doors when it comes to consulting equity opportunities. So I think that's something that is probably obvious to many people, but I've learned and come to appreciate more and more over the past couple of years.
No, I think it's a good point. And she referenced that when she writes for the bigger brands, she can't really do that. They're longer pieces, but she can't really add her own voice or judgment on what she's writing, where she can now. And I would bet if she didn't have the newsletter, but was just writing for these big brands, she would be less in vogue by people doing transactions or trying to stand up brands, etc., just because like they'd be like, oh, that was an interesting piece, but then they'll go off to talk to someone sourced in the piece rather than the person writing it itself.
Yeah, good point. There's not much, as you mentioned, me or I in the New York Times. It is very much telling the story and making it less about you, but that probably caps your opportunity set. Now, a lot of those opportunities, you don't know how they're going to work. There's this interesting thing going on right now with Reddit where I'm going to forget who it was that invested. I think Condé Nast invested $20 million and it's turning into $2 billion. Now, that took 20 years for that investment to pay off the way that it did. Actually, not even 20 million. It was 20,000, some outrageously low number. But what's really interesting about these things is they are massive options. You never know which one's going to work out. But if you don't have them, you'll never reap the benefits. And that's where I think this creator world still has very, very interesting things that could evolve over time. And as the short-term stuff gets a little rocky, those long-term things are still there in a big way.
Yeah. Do you think Condé Nast had even remembered that they had invested in Reddit?
Yes. Yeah. I think Reddit's big enough for them to remember.
And for a long time, it was worth nothing.
I don't know that it was ever worth nothing, but
it was an option. It wasn't producing cash.
It wasn't producing cash. That's correct. Yeah. But that's still something on the balance sheet that is worth something. So
very true.
Again, always fascinated by the trend stuff, capitalizing on that. It's easy to think about how you would do that, but much harder to actually do in practice. But I'm always interested in people who seem to have their ear or their brain is closer to the forefront and they're on the frontier in terms of what's happening rather than just kind of keeping up with the pack. So I'm always interested in people that seem to do a good job of that. And especially over time, it's easy, like kind of initially, but then you kind of graduate out of that and you can lose touch with things. But she seems to have kept a close grasp on things over the years, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I would also love to do like an hour long episode just on trends in general. Like, where do they come from? How do people create them? How long do they generally last? Like, the data would be incredibly difficult to source, but it would be so interesting to look at all of those different things of, do they consistently come from the same place, whether it be brands or businesses, or is it more organic than that? Is it people?
I've thought about this a lot. I completely agree with you. It feels like one of those things where there would be some type of experiment or quantitative study done, and you cannot control all the variables that are involved with making a trend work. I feel like it is the perfect setup to be something that gets completely misinterpreted and there's some study done that completely misses the point, which is what makes it really interesting to me. Like, there's no thing that chaos theory plays into more than something like trends and how they come to be and just like the terminology and all of that. So I also would be really interested in seeing it and then also be probably weight the results pretty low, but I would be fascinated to see what it spits out.
I wasn't expecting Matt Levine to make an appearance in this episode, but
I had never heard that backstory about the fiction story, which is honestly completely amazing. I could have asked her a lot more about that story and what inspired it. Obviously, that was a very intense time for female founders, and I generally believe that they get treated a bit more poorly than male founders in from media. But yeah, I wonder what ticked it off for him. But I could see him absolutely loving it. He seems to have that playful side of him. So pretty interesting.
And you should never discount a lot of what she said. She started the newsletter 5 days a week when she was working a full-time job. She did the documentary while she was doing a full-time job with $3,000, which is honestly pathetic from Adobe. Like, what are you expecting people to do? And yeah, on weekend, and there's just like a certain scrappiness to how she's built her various things over the years, which I highly respect.
Yeah, agreed. The hustle is there big time. So there's been a lot that's gone into it. It's very clear. So yeah.
Thank you for bringing it to my attention.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. And we will catch you next week on Making Media.